We, the companions, all were convinced that he had ceased to be the same Mullah Hussein we knew. Farooqi continues. Mullah Hussein, after that memorable blow, disappeared from our sight. His attendant, who had followed him, later related that Mullah Hussein charged forward amidst a multitude of enemies with bullets raining from all directions, and with strokes of his sword he mowed down whoever was in his way. He headed unharmed for the city of Babul and straight to the home of that despicable fiend Sa'idul Ulama. Mullah Hussein circled his house 3 times and cried out, "Let the coward who incited the holy war against us come out," and by example prove the sincerity of his appeal and the righteousness of his cause. Has he forgotten the requirement for the one who declares a holy war to be at the forefront of his followers? What a sight! Soon the inhabitants surrounded Mullah Hussein and begged for peace. At this moment, the followers were galloping towards Mullah Hussein. The cry of "Ya Sahibul Zaman," shouted at the top of their voices, struck fear in the hearts of everyone. Heaven knows in what hole in his house that frightened mouse was hiding. When the followers saw Mullah Hussein and hers, with a feeling of joy they dismounted and kissed his stirrups. Now it was in the afternoon when Mullah Hussein granted peace, telling the crowd, "Now you witness the ascendancy of the faith of God. Except for a scratch on my face, I and my horse were protected by God from your brutal attack." None of the companions had anything to eat or drink since dawn. Mullah Hussein led his men to a caravanserai. He sent a few men to get water and bread, but they came back empty-handed. They were denied both. Mullah Hussein assured them to put their trust in God and ordered the gates of the caravanserai closed. As the hour of sunset approached, he asked one of the companions to go on the roof and chant the customary call for prayer called Azan. A youth gladly responded. No sooner had he uttered the first word, he fell by the fire of the enemy. Mullah Hussein said, "Let another one among you arise and finish the Azan." Another youth chanted a few words and suffered the same. When third youth finished the call, he also was struck down. Mullah Hussein ordered the gates opened. Leaping on horseback, he and his companions mowed down the assailants outside the gate and made them disappear. No doubt left in their minds, the notable of the city, with the Quran in their hands, walked towards Mullah Hussein, who still was on his horse. They begged for mercy and asked Mullah Hussein to permit them to say a few words. Mullah Hussein, observing their sincerity, dismounted his horse and invited them to sit with him, and ordered tea for them, which none of the companions yet had. Mullah Hussein said, "We, unlike the people of this town, know how to receive the stranger." The notables blamed everything on the notorious divine and requested that by morning they leave for the next town. Then two of them arose and, swearing by the Quran which they had brought, declared their intention to regard them as their guests that night, and the next day under heavy guard they would be escorted to the next town. The attendants of the notables had already gone to fetch food for the companions and feed for their horses. The clock registered 4 hours after sunset, when the companions, by permission of Mullah Hussein, broke their fast. That had been a long day, only an introduction to what was yet to come. At midnight, that cowardly divine summoned the commander of 100 guardsmen. His name was Khosrow. He confided in him that at any time or place which he found right, he must massacre the Babis, leaving no one alive to tell the story. Khosrow objected to the plot and said that these are godly people who sacrifice 3 people trying to say the call to prayer. The shameless man said, "I command you to slay them. The matters of religion are for me to decide. I will stand answerable at the day of judgment." The sun anxiously arose to witness another eventful and exciting day. The notables summoned Khosrow and told him that he must exercise utmost consideration and courtesy toward Mullah Hussein and his men, and refuse any reward. He pretended total submission and assured them that he would bring a written note from Mullah Hussein as to his satisfaction about his services. The notables took Khosrow and his men to the caravansaray to introduce them to Mullah Hussein. Mullah Hussein told Khosrow, "If you do well, great shall be your reward, but if you act treacherously, severe will be your punishment. We commit our cause only to God, and are wholly resigned to His will." Mullah Hussein mounted the charger and gave the signal for departure. His attendant, the one who had walked with him all the way to Maku, raised the call of his master, "Mount your steeds, O heroes of God!" A summon which would be raised over and over in the months to follow. To implement his plan, Khosrow took them through forest. On that narrow road, a few guards were in front, followed by Mullah Hussein and Khosrow riding side by side. As soon as the forest was penetrated, Khosrow gave the code signal, which was relayed to the guards at the tail end of the long line of the horsemen. Soon a few of the Babis were killed and some captured. As soon as the cry of agony reached Mullah Hussein's ears, he halted, dismounted, and protested Khosrow's treacherous behavior. Mullah Hussein said, "It is way past noon, and yet there is no sign of our destination, which you had promised us to reach at noon. I refuse to go any farther with you, and can dispense with your guidance and men." Then Mullah Hussein told his attendant to spread his prayer mat. Khosrow had also dismounted his horse. As Mullah Hussein was doing his ablution, Khosrow told one of his men to tell Mullah Hussein that if he wished to reach his destination, he should deliver to him his sword and horse. Mullah Hussein received the message, but refused to answer and proceeded to offer his prayer. Meanwhile, one of the companions, a man of erudition and courage, sensed the intrigue. He went to the one of the attendants of Khosrow, who was preparing the water pipe for Khosrow, and asked if he could have the honor of taking it to Khosrow. He took the water pipe to Khosrow, who was resting by a tree. Pretending to bend to fix the charcoal, he swiftly pulled out Khosrow's dagger and killed him on the spot. Mullah Hussein was still in prayer when the cry of "Ya Sahibuz-Zaman" was raised again, and in a short time all of the guards who were fully equipped with guns were struck down. The attendant of Khosrow, who had given the water pipe to a follower of Mullah Hussein, threw himself at the feet of Mullah Hussein, begging to be spared. Mullah Hussein accepted his plea and said, "One should live to tell the story." He kindly gave him the jewel-studded water pipe of Khosrow and told him to tell the notables that Khosrow had foolishly demanded his sword and horse, not realizing that their work had just begun. As the night was approaching, they camped in an open spot nearby. Next sunrise, Mullah Hussein told his men, "We are approaching our Karbala," which they understood its meaning. It meant the altar of sacrifice. When he saw some men carrying belongings of Khosrow and his fallen men, he instructed them to discard them. He took a road no one was familiar with, but they all followed him on foot, leading their horses. In half an hour, they reached the shrine of an Islamic saint called Sheikh Tabarsi. His resting place for centuries has been reverently visited by Muslims of the area. You will find its photo on the insert with the photo of the famous sword of Mullah Hussein. The shrine is about 14 miles or 22 kilometers from Babol, where the roadblock was made. The night before their arrival, the custodian or caretaker of the shrine saw a very revealing dream. In it, he saw Imam Hussein, the third Imam martyred centuries ago with 72 warriors, arrive at Sheikh Tabarsi with a number of companions. He saw Imam Hussein engaged in most heroic battles there, triumphant every time. And, to the custodian's amazement, Muhammad, the Prophet himself, is the maternal grandfather of Imam Hussein, joined them at the shrine. Mullah Hussein all along had been praying for his steps to be guided, and here was the answer. The custodian at once recognized him as the hero in his dream, so he threw himself on his feet and kissed him. Somewhat startled about such a welcome, Mullah Hussein asked him to sit by his side and listen to him relate his dream. Mullah Hussein told him, "All that you saw in your dream will come to pass, and the glorious scenes will be enacted." The custodian begged Mullah Hussein to be accepted as one of his companions, and eventually he was martyred there. On the day of their arrival, Mullah Hussein gave instructions to the notable believer who had built the Babiye in Mashhad to start plans for building a fort for their defense. They already were attacked twice and nearly ambushed by the guards. The future was clear and ominous to Mullah Hussein, who had come so close to rescue Quddus, but it was not to be a simple operation. As the evening approached, they found themselves surrounded by a multitude of horsemen preparing to open fire upon them. They claimed to be inhabitants of the home village of Khosrow, the treacherous guard commander, and they had come to avenge his blood. The companions drew their swords again in self-defense, raising the cry of "Ya Sahibuz-Zaman," and leaped onto their horses. So tremendous was the shout that the horsemen vanished as suddenly as they had appeared from the forest. This defense was led by a companion who requested the honor from Mullah Hussein. Fearing the return of the enemy, they pursued them until they reached a village which they thought was Khosrow's village. In the darkness of the night, and with the confusion that ensued, the mother of the owner of the village was accidentally killed. Soon the companions learned that it was not the village of Khosrow. The leader ordered a halt, and when he ascertained that he and his men were led to the wrong village, he became agitated. His distress mounted when he heard about the death of the mother of Nazar Khan, the owner of the village. This was quite heavy on his mind. The companions kept apologizing for the unfortunate mistake, but the leader decided to go to the home of Nazar Khan to explain everything, and by assuming the responsibility, offered himself to take any punishment. After all, the honor of Mullah Hussein and the rest of the followers of the Bab was at stake. Before I tell you how everything was destined to happen for the unfolding of this drama, a clarifying comment is necessary. By hearing some of the details of this episode, some particularly in the West might consider the companions as a bunch of wild and sword-happy hoodlums who had fun engaging in war under the name of religion. No, not at all. Mullah Hussein and his companions were clerics, craftsmen, merchants, and the like. They were more familiar with pen and paper than sword and horse. Carrying a sword in those days in Islamic tradition was not unusual, particularly when going on a mission and riding a horse. The Bab's faith, in its fourth year, had not forbidden the use of sword in self-defense. But in 1863, Baha'u'llah, on the day of his declaration, forbade its use. Lastly, at no time did these defenders attack offensively to gain property or territory. Only when they felt dangerously hemmed in, they unleashed their forces and repulsed the enemy. Matter of fact, during the siege of the fort at later time, Quddus told the defenders that with the ascendancy they had demonstrated over the massive royal army, people of that area were seeing the power of their cause and becoming willing to join them. He said that if he wished to declare a holy war, without doubt, they could conquer the whole country and beyond. But theirs was only to defend themselves against onslaught of the enemy and promote the cause of God. As the story unfolds, one cannot believe how intertwined the events were. You see, Mullah Hussein, on the day of their arrival at the shrine, instructed a believer to start building a fort. They had discarded all their valuables at the beginning of the journey. To build a fort for protection as the first step, even before thinking of rescuing Quddus, was a big undertaking, particularly when they had no money, food, or other provisions. What they had was the most important asset, and that was their trust in God. The last event in the story was that night when the leader of the companions went to the home of Nazar Khan, the owner of the village. He explained to Nazar Khan what had transpired, including the treachery of Khosrow and how the people from his village were trying to avenge his blood. Although grief-stricken about his mother's death, Nazar Khan was so moved by what he heard that he invited the leader to spend the night at his home and the next day take him to meet Mullah Hussein. He also showed great interest to learn about a cause which could enkindle such fervor in the hearts of his followers. At the hour of dawn, the leader, accompanied by Nazar Khan, arrived at the shrine and found Mullah Hussein leading the congregational prayer. Nazar Khan, without any hesitation, joined the worshippers and repeated every prayer that Mullah Hussein uttered. Now the leader had to tell Mullah Hussein about the tragic death of Nazar Khan's mother. Mullah Hussein expressed deepest sympathy on behalf of himself and all of the followers to Nazar Khan. Just a few words from Mullah Hussein transformed Nazar Khan to the point that he told Mullah Hussein, "Had I 100 sons, all of whom I would have joyously placed at your feet as a sacrifice to the promised Qa'im." He pledged his undying loyalty to Mullah Hussein and rushed home to return with whatever provisions were needed. Amazing how submission to the will of God works. One wonders how those 300 men, having no architect, engineer, or power tools, built a fort within a span of 2 months which could sustain the poundings of the army. To add to the obstacles was the shorter days of fall, which retarded drying of the mud used between the trunks of trees. But everything worked like clockwork. The worst obstacle, which could have been the interference of the armed forces, was resolved by a major crisis in the capital, Tehran. In those countries, the transfer of power did not and does not take place smoothly. After the death of the king, the power struggle of ambitious princes and politicians had to take place before the crown prince could claim the throne. The dust finally settled on October 20, 1848, when the coronation of the young king, less than 20, took place. While constructing the fortress, the annoyance of hostile acts of nearby villagers riled up by the enraged divine had to be dealt with by a flyswatter. No doubt, the strenuous and long hours of labor strengthened those determined arms for the critical days ahead. The construction progressed well. As it was near completion one day, a believer arrived with the marvelous news that Baha'u'llah and Nazar Khan would be arriving in the afternoon, and that Baha'u'llah had invited everyone for dinner that evening. Farooqi, who survived the final massacre, related that he saw a beaming joy on Mullah Hussein's face upon hearing of the arrival of Baha'u'llah, but Farooqi had not recognized the station of that nobleman. Under Mullah Hussein's instruction, everyone frantically began to tidy up the place and themselves for the reception of Baha'u'llah. And even Mullah Hussein himself joined them in sweeping and sprinkling water on the approaches of the shrine. As soon as Mullah Hussein saw Baha'u'llah approaching, he rushed forward, embraced him, and conducted him with reverence to the seat of honor. Farooqi states, "The rest of us were too blind in those days to recognize the one whom our commander treated with such love and humility." Mullah Hussein was so lost in admiration that he became totally oblivious of the 300 of us standing, waiting for permission to sit down. It was Baha'u'llah himself who finally permitted us to sit down. Baha'u'llah, in the course of that visit, inspected the fort and expressed his satisfaction with the work and then said, "The only thing missing is the presence of Quddus, which would make the fort complete and the company perfect." Baha'u'llah instructed Mullah Hussein to send a certain believer with 6 men to Sari to demand Quddus's release from confinement. After supper, Baha'u'llah left the fort, counseling them to be resigned to the will of God. Then he stated that, God willing, he would visit them again and come to their assistance. Mullah Hussein at once sent the 7 men to Sari for the release of Quddus, who had been confined for 95 days in the house of a top divine who also was a relative of Quddus. You realize that we are talking about the town of Sari and a different divine than the vicious priest of Babur. As soon as the divine heard Mullah Hussein's message, he unconditionally honored the request. The name of Mullah Hussein had totally disarmed him. He said, "I have all along considered Quddus to be my honored guest, and he is at liberty to do whatever he desires." Well, a convenient change of attitude. No one dared to displease Mullah Hussein. Here comes one touching part of the story. Mullah Hussein, the superhuman commander, gathered his men to prepare them for Quddus, whose station was not known to them. He told them, "You should observe towards him the same reverence that you would towards the Bab. As to myself, you must consider me only as his lowly servant. You should display such loyalty to him that should he command you to take my life, you should not hesitate for a moment. You should refrain from kissing his hands or feet, for he does not approve of it." As you know, the majority of the companions were new converts from Islam and were used to such expressions of reverence. The news of the impending arrival of Quddus brought a joyful tiding, releasing added strength and courage. You can feel the suspense in each man's heart about what was next. Mullah Hussein's burst of enthusiasm could not be repressed. Total darkness had enveloped the fort and the forest. Mullah Hussein gave 2 candles to each follower and lit them himself and told them to proceed and greet Quddus. They surrounded Quddus on his horse and on foot followed him to the fort while chanting the hymn of glorification, "Holy, holy, the Lord our God, the Lord of the angels and the spirits."
صبوح قدوس يا ربنا ورب الملائكة والروح
صبوح قدوس
يا ربنا ورب الملائكة والروح.
Mullah Hussein would chant a refrain, to which the company responded. It echoed throughout the forest. After his arrival, some of Quddus's writings were read to the companions. His reverence to the Bab and Tahiri were easy to understand by the believers, but his praise of Baha'u'llah was not appreciated, since Baha'u'llah appeared in the rich garb of the nobility. Being rich was not an admirable quality in their tradition. The next morning, Quddus asked Mullah Hussein for a head count. Mullah Hussein ordered everyone out of the fort, and when they returned, he counted them. The total, including himself and Quddus, came to 312. Before the gate was closed, Mullah Hussein heard a youth running in the distance and calling. He had come all the way from Babul and flung himself at the feet of Mullah Hussein, pleading to be accepted as one of the companions. His wish was granted, and the number rose to 313. When Quddus was informed about the result of the headcount, he made a reference to a prophecy from Muhammad regarding the assemblage of 313 chosen ones as a sign of the advent of the promised Qa'im. The knowledge and resourcefulness of Quddus gradually removed the doubts of the companions who still considered Mullah Hussein of higher station. Many times in the middle of night, Mullah Hussein was seen to circle around where Quddus was sleeping and utter words of praise. Quddus's new writings were regularly read to the companions, which filled them with wonder and justified his leadership in their limited minds. With the fort completed, some curious and friendly visitors were permitted in. They marveled at what was done in such a short time. Through word of mouth, the depraved divine of Babul heard of its praise and smoldered with jealousy. He constantly preached the neighboring villagers to refuse to sell provisions to them, which some did. He also sent a petition to the young king for the elimination of what, in strong language, he called a menace and a threat to the throne. He could not tolerate the black standard raised above the fort, the banner which had been hoisted in Mashhad in July 1848 and waved continually above the heads of those heroes for 11 months until May 1849. The young king referred the matters to the officers in the province of Mazandaran, where the fort was. They reported back to the king that the handful of frail-bodied students would require only a fraction of the army that His Majesty had contemplated. They maintained that the men in the fort were utterly unworthy of king's concern and consideration, and that a small detachment of the army could easily wipe them out within 2 days. The king agreed and assigned an officer to recruit whatever was necessary for the simple job. Trying to impress his king, in a short time that officer put together an army of 12,000 men equipped with guns and necessary ammunition. They camped at the village of Nazar Khan, overlooking the fort. They stopped any traffic in and out of the fort. With such control, soon a shortage of bread and water prevailed. At sunset, Quddus and Mullah Hussein were viewing the army barricades outside the fort. Quddus told Mullah Hussein, "God willing, this very night a downpour of rain, followed by heavy snowfall, will assist us to repulse their contemplated assault." It exactly happened. It ruined the enemy's gunpowder supply, and the combination of rain and snow supplied the companions with adequate water for a long time. The snowfall was unusual for that season and was so heavy the like of which that region had never experienced even in the depth of winter. Friends, if so far you have not seen the hand of Providence at work, in the course of the coming events, you shall. The date was December 1st, 1848, when Quddus decided to scatter the enemy, which was preparing for attack. 2 hours after sunrise, Quddus, flanked by Mullah Hussein on their horses, led their companions on foot through the gates of the fort with the cry of Ya Sahib al-Zaman, the roar of their voices and the glitter of their drawn swords stunned armed soldiers who, panic-stricken, scattered in every direction. Those who stayed were put to blame. Within 45 minutes, the shout of victory was raised. Within that short span of time, the army commander, 2 of his officers, and 430 soldiers had perished. Not a single casualty among the companions. Only 1 man was wounded. As commanded, they only took the swords and horses of the fallen, ignoring their valuables. Quddus ordered his men to dig a moat around the fort as a safeguard against any future attack, which took them 19 days to complete. It was during the first siege of the fort by the army that Baha'u'llah's attempt to join them ended in his arrest and being bastinadoed, which means the beating of the soles of the feet. It definitely was not God's will for him to reach the fort. Do you remember his parting words? If it be God's will, I will visit the fort again and come to your assistance. You will know why it was not God's will when you hear the ending. Soon after the moat was dug, the news arrived that a prince was advancing towards the fort at the head of a large army. Apparently, the overzealous new prime minister, who later ordered the martyrdom of the Bab, became violently angry at the news of that defeat. Therefore, that prince was given a free rein to finish the job. After setting up his headquarters in a nearby village, he sent one of his men to meet Mullah Hussein and find out what he was up to. Mullah Hussein assured them that his intention was not to subvert or usurp the authority of the king. He wished to assert the rightful claim of the Bab as the promised Qa'im. He asked the prince to arrange for a debate with the leading clergy of Sauri and Babul at the fort. In the presence of the prince, he said, "Let the holy book of Quran decide between truth and falsehood. The prince should be the judge, and I would welcome any punishment should I fail to prove my case." The messenger moved to tears and promised that in 3 days such a meeting would be arranged, but the prince wanted to use the opportunity to impress the king with his tactics and not negotiation. Now he had 3 regiments of infantry and several regiments of cavalry under his command. This definitely was much larger army than the defeated 12,000 force. Tension was high, and the large army restless for the signal. But a different signal. The day had not yet broken, when at the signal of "Mount your steeds, O heroes of God," Quddus ordered the gates opened. Mullah Hussein and other men followed Quddus, and daunted by the forces that surrounded them, or the mud and snow on the road, they charged towards the heart of the camp, the prince's headquarters. With that surprise attack like a bolt of lightning, the companions reached the residence of the prince. The proud prince, not wishing to be cut in half, jumped out of the back window and escaped barefoot. The army went into total chaos, having lost their commander. 2 other princes and the soldiers who showed resistance were struck down. The companions found cases filled with gold and silver in the prince's room, but all they took was a case of gunpowder and the prince's favorite sword as evidence of their triumph for Mullah Hussein. Mullah Hussein had stayed behind with a number of men to check any unexpected move by the enemy. When the companions reached him, they found he was using Quddus's sword because a bullet had struck his own sword. After the men reached Mullah Hussein with the prince's sword, he led the company towards the camp headquarters where Quddus was. Mullah Hussein returned Quddus's sword and ordered the companions to surround Quddus for safety. He remained at full vigilance, surveying the enemy's move. Still, there were a few regiments remaining in the field. All of a sudden, he observed from right and left a mass of soldiers charging from 2 sides towards them. With the cry of "Ya Sahibul Zaman," the companions pressed forward towards the coming host. Some followed Quddus, and the other followed Mullah Hussein in another direction. The oncoming enemy, seeing Mullah Hussein wielding his sword, deflected their direction and charged toward Quddus. The thunderous sound of thousands of bullets fired filled Mullah Hussein with apprehension. Disregarding the shower of bullets, he sped towards Quddus and found the companions repulsing the attack. But, to his horror, he found Quddus bleeding profusely from his mouth. Dismounting his horse, he ran towards Quddus, and seeing what happened to his beloved chief, he raised his hand to beat upon his own head when Quddus signaled him to desist. A bullet had broken several of Quddus's teeth and lacerated his tongue and mouth. Mullah Hussein obeyed his chief, who had remained on his horse. However, he asked Quddus for his sword. Mullah Hussein mounted the charger, and with Quddus's sword in one hand and the prince's in the other, swept through the lines of the enemy. Thank you. charger being given a free rein, like a chariot of fire, tore through the hordes of the enemy, allowing his master to mow them down right and left. With such unmatched heroism, within 30 minutes, the entire army fled with no trace except the dead. Back at the fort, Quddus wrote an appeal to all who were disheartened by his injury. He told them to be resigned to the will of God, and if they loved him, to not spoil the joy of that memorable day by their lamentation. He wrote, "Muhammad also lost his teeth by the stone of the infidels." That unforgettable engagement took place on December 21, 1848, when a handful of inspired heroes disgraced and defeated a large and well-equipped royal army. Truly beyond any explanation, miraculously a few swords silenced thousands of guns. It took more than a month before the demoralized and scattered forces of the prince recovered and began to prepare for the final decisive blow. By this time, several additional regiments of infantry and cavalry and their two brave and seasoned commanders had arrived. Another Goliath against little David. Their combined forces set up a series of barricades to intimidate the occupants of the fort. They engaged in exercising maneuvers, firing their guns constantly for a few days. While you are watching these childish practices, let me go inside the fort and tell you what is transpiring there. The scarcity of water compelled the men to dig a well. As it was near completion, Mullah Hussein told his hard-working comrades, "Today we shall have all water we require for our bath. Cleansed of all earthly defilement, we shall seek the court of the Almighty and shall hasten to our eternal abode. Whoever is ready to partake of the cup of martyrdom, let him prepare himself and be ready to scatter the dark forces surrounding us." I wish I had a cheerful report to give you, but that is the way it was on that February 1st, 1849, within the walls of Fort Sheikh Tabarsi. Mullah Hussein washed and did his ablution, put on a new garment, and adorning his head with the turban of the Bab, prepared for the approaching encounter. Let us not get sad. Alluding to the hour of his departure, his face was beaming with joy. Alone, he sat up all night at the feet of Quddus, who so powerfully reminded him of his beloved master, pouring forth all that was in his heart. After midnight, way before the daybreak, he mounted his charger and commanded the gates to be opened. At the head of his companions, with the powerful cry of "Ya Sahib al-Zaman," which vibrated the fort and the forest, they charged towards the enemy lines. The first barricade Mullah Hussein dealt with was commanded by the enemy's bravest officers. Soon he disposed of his commander and scattered the soldiers. With the same speed and swiftness, he cleared the second and the third barricades. And daunted by the shower of bullets, they pressed forward until the remaining barricades had been all overthrown. In the confusion that ensued, and fearful of his life, one of the commanders climbed a tree. The horse of Mullah Hussein suddenly became entangled in the rope of a tent and before it could free itself, Mullah Hussein's chest was pierced by a bullet of that officer in the tree. However, the officer had no idea whom he had shot. Mullah Hussein, who was bleeding profusely, dismounted his horse, staggered a few steps, and collapsed. Two of his companions carried him back to the fort. Friends, this is too much for me to recount. Two believers, one of whom was Furughi, have related the following account. We were among those who had remained in the fort with Quddus. As soon as Mullah Hussein, who seemed to have lost consciousness, was laid down in the presence of Quddus, Quddus dismissed us and said, "Leave me alone with him. There are certain confidential matters which I wish him alone to know." Then he bade his attendant, a strong believer, to close the door. Furughi continues, "As we sat outside the door, we were amazed to hear the voice of Mullah Hussein answering Quddus. For 2 hours they continued to converse. I had never seen that brave and strong attendant of Quddus so agitated." He later told us that he was watching them through a crack in the door. As soon as Quddus said, "Mullah Hussein," he arose and seated himself on his knees facing Quddus. With bowed head, he listened to every word of Quddus and answered his questions. Then Quddus's final words were, "You have hastened the hour of your departure and abandoned me to the mercy of my enemies. Please God, may I join you soon and taste the sweetness of heaven's delight." And these were the final words of Mullah Hussein. "May my life be a ransom for you. Are you well pleased with me?" Quddus, unable to speak, nodded his head. Mullah Hussein, that indomitable hero, with a gentle smile on his lips, closed his eyes to this world. Furughi states, "A long time passed before Quddus permitted us to enter. Quddus participated in the preparation of his body for burial and put his own shirt on him. As Quddus gave the parting kiss on his eyes and forehead, his lamenting final words were so intense, which made all of those in attendance to weep. Quddus laid the body with his own hands at a site within the shrine near the site where Sheikh Tabarsi had been laid to rest. He cautioned those of us who were within the shrine to keep the site of burial a secret and conceal it even from the rest of the companions." Mullah Hussein was 36 years old when he passed on to the kingdom of eternal glory. The Bab in a tablet of visitation revealed for Mullah Hussein has asserted that the dust of the burial site of Mullah Hussein has the potency to bring joy to the grief-stricken and healing to the sick. Matter of fact, after the events were over, he sent a believer to do a pilgrimage on his behalf to the site of the fort and bring him a handful of dust from the graves of Quddus and Mullah Hussein. Let us pray that the days of emancipation will be hastened, so the pilgrimage of the Baha'is from all corners of the world to that fort and Quddus's resting place will become possible. Since most of you are anxious to learn how it all ended, a brief account will be presented. For details, please refer to the Dawnbreakers. On that second day of February, the day of the martyrdom of Mullah Hussein, the casualty among the companions was heavy. 90 of them were seriously wounded and died later. From the date of their arrival to that tragic day in February, the number of companions martyred reached 72, as foretold by Mullah Hussein. The days of Mullah Hussein's heroic deeds numbered 116 days, which dwarfed and eclipsed all of the heroic deeds of the past. It was the mandate and the will of the Bab, so expressed in his parting words when Mullah Hussein left Maku a year earlier. The disgraceful defeat of that massive army and the loss of 45 experienced officers was a severe blow to those in charge. It took 1.5 months to recover, particularly with the intensity of cold in that winter. However, that hiatus did not relax their prevention of any supplies reaching the fort. With exhaustion of all supplies, Quddus opened the last supply of rice which Mullah Hussein had stored. As Quddus distributed the rice, he warned them about the unbearable trials ahead and excuse whoever wished to leave while the enemy siege was broken. That very night, one traitor defected and informed the enemy that Mullah Hussein was dead, another Judas. He told the commander that on February 2nd, had they persisted, the fort would have been conquered. Up to that time, the enemy did not have that information. It gave them a new resolve. Here are the highlights of the remaining 3 months. With the loss of Mullah Hussein, the confident enemy was preparing and counting on their final deadly assault. But again, the magic cry of Ya Sahibuz Zaman, by only 19 charging companions, scattered the enemy. We can easily see that it was not the strength of numbers of men and arms, but the power of the animating spirit. After Mullah Hussein's death, all defensive sorties were led by Mirza Muhammad Baghir, the stout builder of the fort, whom Quddus appointed to replace Mullah Hussein. The defeat of the commanding officer was both embarrassing and humiliating. While escaping, he fell from his horse with one of his boots stuck in the stirrup. The victory under the new leader brought fresh spirit to those hungry but not broken heroes. They ate the flesh of horses taken from the enemy. In the rank and file of the enemy, each defeated commander was a consolation to the other disgraced ones. Finally, a desperate request was made to the capital for a shipment of cannons and artillery power. Meanwhile, at the fort, the last Nowruz in the life of Quddus and the companions was celebrated. Disregarding hunger, they sang the hymns of praise with which Quddus had been welcomed to the fort.
Ya Rabbana wa Rabbul Malaikati Darruh.
Ya Rabbana wa
Subhuan Quddus Ya Rabbana wa Rabbul Malaikati.
Their daily spiritual sustenance was the new writings flowing from the pen of Quddus. On the ninth day of Nowruz, artillery shells began to pound the fort. Quddus, calmly walking in the open, rolled a cannon ball with his foot and assured the followers. The photo of one such cannon ball is on the insert. With continuation of shelling by the enemy and expectation of unconditional surrender, they were badly surprised by the loud hymns of joy and regular calls to prayer reaching their ears from the fort. One wonders how many soldiers saw the power and greatness of the cause and later embraced it. Meanwhile, the food of the companions was reduced to grass, boiled water, and chewing on the leather of their saddles and belts. Frustrated with the fervor of the companions, a tower was erected by the army, from the top of which they directed their shelling at the heart of the fort. Quddus summoned Mirza Muhammad Baghir and said, "Go and inflict a humiliation on this new commander no less than the previous one. Let him know that although hungry, the lion-hearted heroes can still roar." Again, he and 18 companions, with the cry of "Ya Sahib al-Zaman," toppled the tower and demolished the barricades with none of the believers scratched. For 1 month, attacks were halted due to an explosion in the ammunition depot where a number of officers and soldiers died. Once again, the cannons began their fire, but were silenced with another counter-offensive. Now has passed about 5 months of siege with no sign of progress, even with their big guns. The only weapon left was treachery. At first, they stopped all offensive. Then a Qur'an signed and sealed by the prince commander was sent to Quddus, swearing a safe passage for everyone, with their expenses paid to return to their hometowns. Quddus honored the holy book, and the gates for the last time were opened. As the companions came out of the fort, they were taken to army's headquarters and separated into groups, but soon the foul play of barbaric and brutal massacre ensued, blaspheming the Qur'an upon which they had falsely promised peace. produce was handed over to Sa'idul Ulama, the bloodthirsty priest in Babul, who was impatiently awaiting his precious trophy to assure his own eternal damnation. That fiend had sadistically planned the prolonged parade of Quddus in chains and despicable tortures on the way to the main square. As Quddus reached the square, he raised his voice, "Only if my mother could be here to watch the splendor of my wedding night." At his final moments, before he was struck down by the axe of that priest, he prayed for his tormentors. Then those ravenous beasts fell upon him, cutting him into pieces, feeding the parts into a blazing fire prepared and planned by that fiend. Quddus was only 27 years old, and the date was May 16, 1849. Past midnight, when everyone was gone, under the direction of a compassionate and pious divine, Haji Muhammad Ali Hamza, the charred remnants were buried at a site not too far from that square. You should also hear the special circumstances surrounding the martyrdom of Mirza Muhammad Baghir, whom Quddus appointed as the leader of their counter-offensive sorties after the death of Mullah Hussein. Mirza, a distinguished and learned man, was the one who built the Babiye in Mashhad and later the fort at Sheikh Tabarsi. He and another companion were sent to the town of Aghmol, where 6 months before Baha'u'llah, after being intercepted on his way to the fort, had been confined and bastinado. Upon their arrival, the horrible tortures inflicted upon his friend threw Mirza into a fit of rage. When the executioner approached them, Mirza freed his tied hands and snatched a sword from the executioner. He struck the executioner with such force that his head rolled about 15 feet away. The crowd rushed towards him, but he mowed down all who came within his reach. Finally, they had to shoot him, which was a more merciful death. In his pocket, they found a dry piece of roasted horse flesh, a proof of what he and all those heroes had to endure for their faith. Those thick walls and the gate of that fort, still vibrating with the cry of those heroes, were meticulously raised by authorities to efface the least evidence of the army's repeated humiliations and their final treacherous blasphemy. How naive, how ignorant, the spilled blood of the martyrs could never and shall never be silenced. That month of May 1849, that part of northern Iran on the shores of the Caspian Sea, witnessed the bloody end of so heroic and so tragic events of four Sheikh Tabarsi. Let the resonating, earth-shaking cry of Ya Sahibul Zaman and the hymns of those valiant heroes fill the air and reverberate till the end of time.